This hour begins with the takeaway and a discussion about Baltimore's mayor. She's in the midst of a scandal about her published kids' book series and the payments she received for those books. Then on Insight, Yosemite's famous glaciers. John Muir discovered the largest, the Lyell Glacier, in 1871, but the masses of ice had been there long before that. The melt rate of the Lyell and others accelerated with a drought a few years ago. Now the glaciers are disappearing and they're endangered. I'll talk with investigative reporter Daniel Duane about his story just published in the California Sunday magazine. Daniel trekked to the Lyell with Yosemite geologist Greg Stock. We'll hear about their firsthand look at the landscape. Daniel's article is titled, What Remains? I'm Beth Ruyak. That's Today on Insight, but we're going to begin the hour with the takeaway. Live from the Capital Public Radio studio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Ruyak. Glaciers helped shape some of the majesty of Yosemite National Park. Glaciers are big, slowly moving bodies of ice. And in Yosemite, as in other parts of the world right now, the glaciers are disappearing. It can be complicated to work through the timeline of the Earth's ice ages and know exactly when Yosemite's glaciers formed. But researchers do know that the drought in the West from 2015 until about last year accelerated their shrinking. In the latest California Sunday magazine, just published today, an article titled What Remains focuses on Yosemite's glaciers and the impact of climate change on California's public lands. The writer, investigative reporter Daniel Duane, is joining us right now from the UC Berkeley campus. Hi, Daniel. Glad to have you on Insight.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
What drew you to Yosemite and its glaciers? There's an obvious answer in that they fascinate all of us. But for you in particular, what was it?
Well, I did, like a lot of Northern Californians, I grew up going to the Sierra every summer with my parents and going to Yosemite. And I took up rock climbing with my dad up there. And so I've been a climber up there for about 30 years. And it's just a place that's dear, quite dear to my heart. The glaciers are, a part of its majesty.
Would you map out, so to speak, what's still there in terms of active glaciers and at what elevation?
So in terms of active glaciers, there's really only one left. There is a glacier called the McClure Glacier. Until a few years ago, the answer to that question would have been that there are two, the Lyell Glacier and the McClure Glacier. At this point, though, the Lyell Glacier is the park geologist, Greg Stock, who, is studying it, struggles with what to call it. Should we rename it the Lyell Stagnant Ice Field? But in terms of actively moving ice, the only one that's left is really this one called the McClure.
So the glaciers are up at about 12,000 feet or higher. The Lyell hangs off a mountainside. And will you talk a bit about a line in your story that reads, glaciers are conveyor belts, not bulldozers? Because I think that's a different image from what we learned in science class as youngsters.
Very much so. And I was caught by that because when I went up to the Lyell with Greg Stock, the park geologist in Yosemite, National Park Service employee, I think he sort of detected that I had a kind of mistaken understanding of how glaciers, gouge out mountain valleys and move big amounts of rock and all that. I thought they kind of did it like a bulldozer, this sort of massive tongue of ice shoving rock in front of it.
Right.
I think that's a pretty common misconception. And it turns out that glaciers, they do a little bit of that, but they mostly do this more sort of complicated thing of plucking rock up off of the bedrock, beneath them, and then slowly carrying that rock downhill in their sort of inch by inch, almost molasses-like riverine movement, and then depositing those rocks far downslope. So it's not quite the process I'd imagined.
Say a little bit more about the Lyell Glacier. And Greg Stock is an important voice in this story. You hiked with him last fall to Lyell. So that's a lot wrapped up in one question, but let's get more specific about this ice mass called Lyell.
Okay, so the Lyell, you know, glacier or ice field as it is now, but is one of enormous sort of cultural significance because of the time and the way in which it came into the Western consciousness and the time and the way in which it is now, you know, exiting this world as a glacier. It came into the Western consciousness in 1872 at a time of enormous interest in the age of the Earth. This was a time when most of the educated world, you know, really sincerely understood the age of the Earth to be about 6,000 years, according to the Bible. That's just what all of us listening to, you know, the NPR of the 1872 would more or less have believed. And sort of through the early to mid 1800s, geologists on both sides of the Atlantic had found increasing evidence that the Earth was a lot older than that. And some of that evidence came in the form of signs that much of northern Europe had once been covered in masses of ice. This led to the theory of the Ice Age, as it was at the time, this theory that there had been some earlier time of, you know, of ice in the northern hemisphere, this understanding that ice had gouged out landscapes. And this was all quite, you know, sort of thrilling and interesting, kind of the way stories about, you know, genetics are today. And at the same time, Yosemite had been, you know, invaded by a settler colonial sort of death squad and publicized to the Western world. And it had become sort of a new wonder of the Western world, as it were. And so there was great interest in the question of how Yosemite was made. The professional geologists of the day were convinced that Yosemite had been made by this sort of wild cataclysm they imagined, in which the floor of the valley had sort of plummeted downward, exposing the cliffs on either side. John Muir, who was kind of a nobody at the time, you know, he'd worked for a guy who owned a hotel in Yosemite but was fascinated with the natural history, he thought it plain as day that glaciers had carved Yosemite Valley into being. And he, in order to support that hypothesis, he wandered around the Yosemite High Country until he found some big, huge sheets of ice, and he performed some sort of rudimentary but quite accurate experiments demonstrating that they were, in fact, living, moving glaciers. Among these were the Lyell. So the Lyell sprang into the Western mind as the creator of this great thing out west called Yosemite and as one of the first living glaciers ever identified in North America. So that's sort of the beginning of the story. There's a lot in the middle, but the end of the story is that, of course, the Lyell is exiting this world as not so thrilling at all, but rather as a kind of, you know, harbinger, a warning sign.
Before we get to that point, it is interesting when you think about time to know that it was only in 1883, which in terms of ice ages and glaciers and the formation of the Earth is really in new time, when the geologist Israel Russell took the very first picture of the Lyell Glacier. And John Muir's discovery, which you're talking about, I think, as you write in your article, had only been 12 years earlier. So we haven't really known about this all that long.
That's right. I mean, at the time that Muir was looking for those glaciers in the Sierra, as recently as just a few years earlier, no professional geologist had ever identified any glacier in the continental United States. There were not believed to be any. And a team of California geologists also, led by a guy named Clarence King at the time, had just found a few others in the Cascades, and it was enormous national news. I mean, there were, you know, big lectures at learned societies back east just that there were any glaciers. It had been declared that there were none at all anywhere in the Sierra Nevada. Mm-hmm. And so John Muir's discovery, or shall I say finding of, because of course people had lived in and around those glaciers for, you know, we don't know how long, 10,000, 20,000 years, it's unclear. But his identification of the Lyell as a glacier and public publicization of that idea you know, amounted to the first ever evidence that there were these thrilling things called glaciers in the Sierra Nevada. So it, and then yes, 1883, this geologist Israel Russell stands far below Mount Lyell in what is called the Lyell Canyon now, this enormous sort of magnificent U-shaped gorge, and takes this beautiful, you know, sort of haunting black and white photograph looking up at what appears at the time to be, you know, you can picture Mount Lyell as this kind of tooth-like summit atop a broad, sprawling, you know, mass of black metamorphic rock, and the Lyell Glacier as, at the time, a sort of broad and thick shawl of white laying heavy across the shoulders of that mountain below the summit.
You're listening to Daniel Duane. He's the writer of the California Sunday Magazine's April 2019 cover story, What Remains. His work has been in the New York Times, in Food and Wine, in Men's Journal. And the article is just published today. We'll post a link to it. I do want to get to your exploration, actually making the hike, Daniel, and standing there on, let's for the sake of the conversation, the Lyell Glacier, call it a glacier at this point.
Yeah.
How was it to have it underfoot?
It's a startling thing to experience. I've been on big, healthy glaciers in other parts of the world, in South America and Alaska, and they, you know, they have a sort of overwhelming grandeur and magnificence to them. They're big beyond imagining, and they have these massive ice falls of house-sized blocks of ice that creak and tumble sometimes, and you know, there's a sense of power in them. The Lyell Glacier ice field, or the Lyell Dying Glacier, whatever we're going to call it, you know, it's from afar, it wouldn't even occur to you that it was a glacier. It just looks like sort of a very big patch of snow on the side of a mountain. And then when I stepped up onto it, you know, the thing that struck me most of all was a kind of fragility. In a way, the whole thing was just, you know, you picture about 60 acres, a 60-acre field of ice on a mountain slope that is maybe 30 or 40 degrees, so a steep mountain slope, this big, big patch of ice. And first of all, it's sort of crunching and breaking underfoot as you walk on it, because the whole surface of it is composed of this almost very fragile lace of, like, you know, of almost fine glass of ice that's breaking under your feet. And then the entire thing is melting at once. There's these big bathtub-sized depressions everywhere filled with meltwater that's sort of filling up and spilling over down to the next one. And although that is a lovely sound to hear, you know, the sound of pristine, clear drinking water cascading down a million little waterfalls all around you all at once, you know, it's also a rather concrete way to experience climate change and the melting out, the disappearance of the cryosphere, the frozen part of the world. It's sort of happening right there.
Your article does address that bigger issue of climate change and the impact. I want to get back to the idea of that first photo in 1883 when Lyell was 13 million square feet of ice. Now, as of about the last couple of years, it's amounted to maybe 3 million square feet of ice or less. And that geologist Greg Stock, whom you hiked with, was, because he's been studying it, the one with the stark reality, and I'm going to read from your article, given the Lyell's melt rate, it would disappear in 4 or 5 more years of drought. And the shock of this realization forced Stock to confront what the data had been hinting at. The Lyell was no longer a glacier at all, and Stock was the last person ever to study it. At what point might it be gone, Daniel?
Well, you know, very heavy winters like we're having right now slow its disappearance, not because they add ice to the glacier, but rather because they cover it in a blanket of snow, so that, you know, throughout the coming spring and summer, the sun will be beating down on that overlaying, insulating blanket of snow, once that blanket of snow melts out, then the sun will be hitting the ice proper and beginning to melt it again. But as Greg told me, half a dozen years of drought, really dry. And, you know, someone could be sitting up there and watching the very last bit of ice, liquefy and trickle downstream and, you know, flow over the rocks and evaporate.
Greg Stock was interviewed by Cap Radio's environment reporter Ezra David Romero for our podcast, Yosemite Land. I thought it would be interesting to hear Ezra talking with Greg about the rock falls that are also happening in the park.
Greg's bringing me to a part of Yosemite Valley that they've physically altered to keep people out of the way of possible rock falls. It's a camping area called Half Dome Village, formerly known as Curry Village.
We're off in the woods. There's lots of big boulders around. And on the ground are remnants of old foundations. There's concrete and rock that form the foundations for a whole lot of wooden cabins.
The cabin sat under Glacier Point, which towers 3,200 feet over Half Dome Village. They were built in the 20s and 30s, and in 2008, there was a big rockfall here.
There were car-sized boulders that were rolling into Curry Village and flattening cabins. And there fortunately were not people in the cabins at that exact moment, but they had been in there the night before.
That close call started a rockfall study, and the cabins were removed in 2013.
And the following year, in 2014, in the middle of the night, there was a washing machine-sized rock that came off the cliff, and it landed right in the middle of this now foundation. But if the cabin hadn't been closed and removed, it would have come right through the roof of a cabin in the middle of the night, with people sleeping in it, most likely.
I could geek out on this topic all day, but one last thing. Greg is unsure how much climate change has to do with how often rockfalls occur, but he'd like to figure that out.
So that was Ezra David Romero from the Cap Radio podcast, Yosemite Land. Anything to add, Daniel, from your conversation with Greg about rockfalls and other impacts of climate change on Yosemite?
Well, just that, you know, the national parks are, they're this kind of, you know, birthright of every American citizen, this place that we put fences around, as it were, and declared, sort of pristine and protected from the ravages of industrial civilization. And science is now, showing us that we can't put fences around climate change. And these places we all love and depend upon for recreation and fun and renewal and naps and meadows and swims and cold streams and all of that, these places are really starting to unravel, and they deserve our, they deserve our love and attention. And so I guess that's what I'd add.
I want to give you a really quick question we had from a listener. Take a listen.
Hello, my name is Rose, and I'm very concerned about our environment. My question is, does the damming that we've done to our rivers have any effect on the glaciers?
You'll have to give a real quick answer, Daniel.
The damming does not affect the glaciers, no. That's my understanding.
Okay. So just a few seconds left. Your personal conclusion about all this, Daniel?
Oh, my personal conclusion is, please believe in science. Trust what they're telling us.
That is writer Daniel Duane. His article, What Remains, will be available in the California Sunday Magazine on Thursday, April 4th, which is today. Thanks for joining us, Daniel.
Thank you for having me.
And you can find a link at capradio.org. This is Insight on Cap Radio. I'm Beth Ruriak. Our producers are Cody Drabble and Bert Johnson. We had help from Sally Schilling. Thank you as well to Ezra David Romero. The digital team is Chris Hagen, Emily Zentner, and Casey Gardner. Our technical director is Mark Jones. Our engineers today, Anthony Van Hook and Antonio Munoz. Insight's executive producer is Joe Barr. Thanks for joining us.